appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. Thoroughly enjoyed the prior topic. I think there are tie-ins. They'll be subtle, but relevant. If I can control this. Because I'm employed by a public agency, if you are a Medicaid eligible person in Los Angeles County, please ignore any sales speech I might give. That's certainly not the intent of this presentation. So I'll proceed according to this outline. The learning objectives I'll cover at the end, but in general. The dilemma that I wrote this about is we understand the need to protect members' privacy and understand that there's an interplay between that and the response rates we get on our surveys. So on the one hand, I want to see this protection in place, but on the other hand, the privacy protections as implemented frequently by survey organizations and accrediting organizations are sometimes so restrictive that we can't do analysis that would help our members, help find out where our services need improvement. So that's the dilemma, is the trade-off between those two things, sort of balancing the benefits of analytics against the potential harm to the member of retaliation. But specifically, the harm of the downside or the other side of the trade-off is that if we know a member is going to give us a bad rating, will we do something to harm their coverage? And I'll address that during the briefing as to what is the likelihood of that. If a company were to try to do something bad, what's the chance and what's the benefit? What are the economics of that? This is the impact of overprotection on analytics. This is what is at stake. And I don't know if this addresses the gentleman's question about what is analytics for us or for me, for my desk. This is what it means. I want to analyze causes of things, and that means I need rich data to be able to get at a cause. And our membership don't answer uniformly. For instance, if I know one demographic about them, they don't answer uniformly. I tried to post stratification correction to some of our data one year, and it didn't gain me anything in precision. The members just are not uniform. And so the precision of the data is such that even if I knew the member's identity, it's still a difficult task to identify causality. So I need any advantage I can get for analytic purposes. Evaluation of programs, we want to be able to evaluate if the member got a particular intervention, that's a 1, and if they didn't, that's a 0, and that's a perfect setup for an analysis, but I need to be able to attach that data to the member's responses on the survey. The survey I'm talking about is the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, or CAPS. About 70% of members, of people insured nationwide, are under a health plan that submits data to the National Committee for Quality Assurance, NCQA. And so they participate in this survey nationwide. And so it's widespread, a source of information on members' ratings of the quality of services that they get. It's an important study in the world I inhabit. The feasibility and the precision of the multivariate analysis is limited by outright prohibitions due to cell size, which is not a bad approach. But coarse coding and aggregate continuous variables, sometimes firms inject noise into it, like they will randomly blind some of the data. They'll add some noise to it and not necessarily tell me which cases that they've altered. And so that's one way to protect privacy, but it's kind of adds some uncertainty that makes the analytics not too usable. And then the cumulative nature of the restrictions, there's a time component to this, that if I ask for XYZ variables back, age, gender, ethnicity, language, I use up all my degrees of freedom in one year, then the next year, if I want something different attached to the previous year's data, I can't, because then it's at risking anonymity. And so I have to decide in advance to leave myself a wiggle room for something I may need 3 years down the line. One other reason time matters is that the sample sizes for CAPS, stipulated by NCQA, are for comparing whole health plans. They're not for doing drill downs. And so I need to pool over time. And so each variable that I've got lasts for at least 3 years. A 3-year cycle is not bad for identifying a cause. the different approaches for balancing this risk versus reward. The risk should be, and these are statements of what I would like to see in policy, risk should be expressed as net risk, as risk to health plan rises, risk to the patient declines. And the higher the amount likely to penalties to the health plan, the less restrictive the anonymity policy needs to be. So that's part of the equation is, if we misbehave with data, with numbers data, if somehow we re-identify the case and say, this person gave us a bad rating last time, so we're going to retaliate by limiting their coverage or making it uncomfortable so that they leave, there are consequences to that. In fact, there one of them is regulatory. We can get penalized for that. But the other consequence is the member can go to the press and we look terrible. And so the incentive, the disincentive to misbehave is quite large. And so that part's calculable. The risk of the patient is somewhat the risk of re-identification is calculable. That's a statistical problem. The risk of retaliation is boundable. And the uncertainty of the consequences for the patient are variable. That's the area of concern, is that if it's a very sick patient, then messing with their coverage whatsoever is much more serious for that person than the average patient. For the health plan or the survey firm, that there are different risks too. And I'm just arguing there that the risk isn't solely about re-identification. There's a risk on both sides of it, and that's a protection to the patient because they have recourses. And ensuring anonymity in health surveys. The restriction by types of identifiers, for instance, the safe harbor for provisions in HIPAA, define risk qualitatively rather than numerically. That's a concern. The pro for that is the nature of the risk and the quality of the protection are intuitive, but it works as a one-size-fits-all rule. In a moment, I'll illustrate one of the problems that raises. The self-service rules are a different approach to it. The CMS uses and I believe the census uses a similar sort of approach in terms of a cell size to protect anonymity. Cell size means that for all of the demographics in a particular table or data set that are given in that data set, do they cumulatively add up for the people in the sampling frame? At least if you have a cell size rule of 30, there shall be at least 30 people. And so the one person who responded, I would have to retaliate against 29 others in order to guarantee that I got the one person that is at risk of re-identification and retaliation. And so the cell size puts in the mix enough other cases that the one person is protected. That's the rationale of a cell size rule. The nice thing about it is it's self-calibrating for plan size, so that as you get a larger plan, there's less risk to each individual member of being re-identified. Whereas as a small health plan, there's a higher risk. And so having a self-calibrating rule means it's not one-size-fits-all. It's right-sized for each entity. Some applied methods on cell size. This is a little better illustration on the next slide. One problem with choosing the data sets, choosing which variables to get back. My survey firm gave me age 1 year, and age, of course, is fine-grained, and that killed any chance of adding anything else. So I had to stipulate in the contract, I'll choose the variables, and I'll group the variables. So in general, we employ a rolling list of demographics so that anything I need to analyze in the next 3 years I put in, and then phase that out, so it's not ever reattached again to the older data. Until the data set is big enough that the risk is lowered to where I meet the cell size constraint and can add new variables. Data destruction agreements are another way out of the problem, that if we have somebody of consequence in the health plan, a HIPAA privacy officer or a data security person sign off, our survey firm has agreed to, if we agree that we've destroyed all past data sets, they can strip off the identifiers they left in the last data set they gave us and give us a new data set for past years. Gives me the advantage of pooling, but gives the protections they're required to provide under their NCQA certification. This is a statistical problem, how to calculate the cell size restriction and its impact. I'll give in a moment an illustration. This, of course, the cell size rule of 2 is ridiculous, a ridiculously large risk to the patient, but if it's on the page here, Okay, so if you have a cell size rule of two, gender is releasable because gender only has at least two people in each cell in this limit data set. State is releasable for the same reason, but if you know state and gender simultaneously, it's not releasable because that exposes Sam and Jane individually. I can identify them as perfectly as I knew their social security number, or their, in this case, I know their name. So that's in a state and gender by themselves in this data set are a perfect identifier. So the cell size rule would protect against that. An argument I kind of presented earlier was that the risk problem may be overstated because of other things built in. For example, patients increasingly have appeal rights and regulatory sanctions. Problem is many of them would not complain, they would just suffer in silence if a health plan were misbehaving. There are legal rights in some jurisdictions so they can recover for damages. An ombudsman function offered by the local media is a very real thing. If a health plan, and this has happened in our county, accidentally had information hit the internet, they're required to publish in the press a notification about these data have been released. And so it's very embarrassing for those companies. Some firms that have a great reputation otherwise have accidentally had release of data and had to do their mea culpa in public. And that's a strong incentive for the organization that I work with and others to not screw up. Retaliation against survey respondents for giving negative ratings would assume that the negative respondent will be surveyed again in the upcoming survey cycle. Okay, so if Jane Doe says, my health plan is terrible, what's the value of retaliating against Jane Doe? Unless I know that she's going to be in the survey the next cycle, she can't harm me. That I won't get that opinion again because we have about a 1 in 500 chance of hitting the same person, hitting one person in 1 year. But then it's multiplicative to see that same person in the sample the next year. So retaliation wouldn't do me any good unless that's a large chance that person will be rating me the next year. And so that is a protection to some extent, that the chance of the person giving a bad rating 2 years in a row is pretty low. The probability and the calculation of given. In example is 0.002 of seeing that person again. There's another issue on retaliation, is that the members are worth something to health plans. If, for example, $100 a month, $12,000 per year loss, some companies may make the decision to say, even if we knew to a certainty who's going to give us a bad rating, they would still opt for the coverage, the money that person represents to the health plan. So that's a factor protecting the member too. And I think anybody making a rational decision would be looking at both of these factors, the low probability of seeing the person in the sample twice and the value they represent. In this case, it's if the cell size rule is 10, you'd have to knock off the 10 people in that set of demographics to be able to benefit at all from retaliation. And there's a cost to that, other than the legal costs and the regulatory penalties. The next set of slides deals with misapplications of anonymity rules. Some public-sponsored surveys and repositories restrict access to de-identified data, which boggles my mind. Here's de-identified data where no identifiers appear. It's been declared de-identified, and yet we're still restricted from seeing it. And a number of major databases are of this sort, where the privacy protections are being used to prevent access, except to a certain number of researchers that the shepherds of the database consider to be beneficial research. And so we contribute data into a repository, for example. We can't get our own data back without jumping through a number of hoops, and even then may not get approval. So that's, in the name of privacy, I'm not sure that's a good thing to be doing. Stringent rules mean we're unable to monitor our vendor. For example, I would like to listen in on our vendor when they're phoning to make sure, one, they're doing the survey, they're doing it right, they're not rushing the member, we're getting valid data back. But I cannot hear the first part of the phone call ever. And so I'm always, because that identifies the member, but I never know, are they giving me a representative snapshot of who they're interviewing? Do they cut out all the bad interviews? So I wanted to be able to monitor them. In theory, the accrediting organization does, but they don't listen in on the calls either, I'm pretty sure. So it limits my ability to monitor the vendor. I kind of, in a weak sense, ask them to attach the time and date of each contact they made to make sure that they're not doing things at a convenient time that would have sampling bias, to where they're only catching people who are there in the middle of the day, which is the cheapest time to staff and call center. Survey firms quote widely different cell sites. This has been interesting. Each year I do a contract with survey firms. I've gotten wildly different responses from them as to what rule they observe. There's the CMS rule, which I believe is a cell size of 10, and it's ranged anywhere from 10 to 30 that I hear quoted, or even as high as 50. And in one instance, a major survey firm said, we base it on the sample and cell size based on the respondents, which has nothing to do with the risk. It's the sampling frame that determines the risk. So there's no uniformity of an application of these protection rules. Another question the gentleman mentioned earlier, in terms of the NCQA, I know, used to specify that the reason for anonymity is response rate. They don't want to harm the response rate, and that agrees with what you mentioned. The question I have is whether people even believe the promise of anonymity. We ask open-ended questions, and in the open-ended questions, members often give me information. One of my tasks is to strip out, they'll name their child, they'll name their doctor, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that doesn't mean everyone wants to waive their right to privacy just because one member named a doctor. But the question is, I'd love to see what the members really think about it. Do they even believe there's a privacy protection, in which case we're incurring the harm of low response rate for no reason? So it would be useful to see research on that. The risk of re-identification is driven by population size, I mentioned, restriction by units, for instance, the safe harbor provision. Some large health plans have more Medicaid members than entire states. We have a provider group that has 100,000 members. That's larger than the Medicaid population in some states. Any health plan within one of those small states that submits data to NCQA gets they get data back with certain demographics identified, where the risk of re-identifying those members in those states is much larger than us re-identifying a member because we have such a large population. The flip side of that problem is that in states where they're getting back the same level of data but much smaller sampling frames, they're able to drill down, whereas our members don't have the benefit of us drilling down to find out which clinic gave bad service. So a person benefits less from quality improvement studies in our county under these restrictions. So a cell size rule is rational and self-calibrating. Some options for actionability would be sharing knowledge about anonymity practices, and thankful to have a forum in which to air this issue. Consider a sunset policy. This is kind of the opposite of data destruction. It's saying, like the census, will lift anonymity after 75 years. That's a little long in terms of healthcare improvement, but I would argue that the risk of re-identification over time, that having a sunset like 3 years or 4 years, still gives some value. It limits your research to persistent problems, but maybe that's not a bad thing. That if something's a continued problem for 3, 4, 5 years, then it's a systemic problem. And so a sunset rule would allow that sort of data to reach me to identify problems. Some safety valves that the industry is working out. The cover letters we give, we are allowed to do member-identified surveys where the member's name is known to us, as long as we alter the cover letter to where the member is not promised anonymity, and then the fact that they're giving us the answer voluntarily. We do have to tell them that their rights will not be harmed under this, that they don't have to answer the survey, and their coverage won't be harmed whether they answer or not, or by what they answer. Then they make a choice. The question is that an informed choice in terms of the risks? And I would argue, because the risks are pretty low, that may be enough. Other organizations like the CASRO is a consortium of survey firms that they want low they don't want low response rates either, so they place restrictions on their survey firms to release data back to us, that we shall not contact a member individually based on the responses that we see in member identified data. So we sign this agreement each year that we won't use this to target individual members, and because it's in the contract, nobody has approached me to do that, but I could picture it happening. But our hands are tied in terms of giving the data to units that would use it in this fashion. Promotion of cell size standards would help us. Health plans sometimes have more than one patient survey in a year, so we conduct one that's anonymous and one that's member identified, and it gives us a snapshot. Kind of a recap, quick recap into almost 0 minutes I have left. Health data contain very personal and sensitive information. We already have some of the most private information you can conceive of for members. The one thing we don't have is we don't know if their rating is poorly or well, and we don't want to know individually. But within some noise factor, within a cell size of 10, that would allow us to find out where we're dropping the ball. Different impacts. I think I've covered most of this. The trade-offs, and then how to calculate the risk and so forth. And then approaches, sparse variables, just quickly the math of it. The way to cure an anonymity problem in release of demographics is you group, you aggregate, and if the health plan retains control over that rather than the survey vendor, then we can choose our own risk. We can choose what to include and what to exclude. And thank you very much. Good or bad? That would be one possible
solution. For purposes of reanalysis, I can see if you reanalyze it using smaller cell size, then is that what you have in mind, or what do you have in mind?
I'm not sure if this answers it or not. To really do good analysis, I have to pool across years. I have data from 2006 to present year in the hands of the survey firm. They're the repository. They're the ones who can know who answered the question, but I can't. And so what I would want them to do is attach a variable and then have some mathematics by which they can control total risk. But if after 3 years the anonymity dissolves, then I can have them attach that variable to a member's data and then provide a data set back to me where I could analyze it. Now, the question is, what's the risk to the member? And wiser people than me should make that determination in terms of what's the risk and how do you protect the member from retaliation? Because that's not the intention of my research for improving services. But still, I would argue that the risk goes down over time. The further we get apart from their rating, then the less I can assume that person's going to still be angry because Dr. So-and-so offended them. And therefore, they're going to hold a grudge after 4 years. That, I doubt, would happen very much. And so the risk diminishes over time for that particular year's answer to persist with that member. For us, we have a different problem that Medicaid people move in and out, and so the chances are pretty low anyway. But then it would be nice to have that information become accessible again to me, because the member's gone already, and then I can analyze, though. I learn more about what the doctor's doing than about what the member's doing. That's the point of the survey, is how are we performing, not how does the member rate us. Hello?
I'm just thinking that
I do not know. And
I teach a course where I have like 11 students, and they do evaluations at the end of the course.
Yeah.
And if I think real hard, I'd probably figure out who is who.
Yeah.
But I can never be entirely sure. And, you know, and it would take some kind of strange mind to try to identify that one individual and then execute some retaliation against them. How fictional is all of this?
As a patient and as a former student, I like the idea of the protections. For instance, companies do employee surveys, and I know of units in some companies where people just don't answer because they say, we're in a small unit and we don't want to be retaliated against. I think anyone standing here has an interest in seeing those seeing protections of some sort.
Actually get back to the individual provider, the actual responses of an individual person back to an individual provider?
If you're a quality improvement director and your CEO is telling you, I want you to improve the provider communication measure, and if you as the quality improvement director have 15 members naming a doctor, there's a good chance that quality improvement director is going to be really tempted to go back and lay this on the desk of the provider and say, you shape up. And then the doctor would say, I know how to improve my scores. Get rid of those patients.
Well, wouldn't they get the aggregate data? They wouldn't see the individual data.
I think your question was, how would it get back to the doctor?
Right. How
it would get back to the doctor, individually.
Individuals.
Because that's going to have the most impact if I tell a doctor, you had this patient on this day you messed up with. That's going to have the best impact. If I'm the quality improvement director, I go for what has the most impact. So there is a risk. Is that convincing?
I just can't imagine any place that would be like that.
Yeah,
but, you know.
I can't imagine wanting to myself, but if I'm on the other side of the equation, I can see then the protection would comfort me. I'm not sure who was next. We're going geographical.
Not a question anymore, that you can't really kick someone out of an insurance?
Well, no, that's not how. People who are opponents of HMOs would tell you, this is how to do it. You make the person uncomfortable. You give them the impression they're not going to get quality service, and they leave on their own. I mean, an imaginative mind can think of ways other than booting them off the service. Any other question? How is our time?
It's not just about retaliation, it's also about inequality. So I used to work in then as an external quality review organization. So we do a lot of this work.
An EQRO.
It's not just about, you know, making sure that there's no chance of retaliation. Because I would say since we served in EQRO, we took all the data in and we gave only like reports back out. There was no like risk that they could re-identify. But if we didn't convince the members that it was a safe place for them to give us their honest opinion, then it was kind of worthless. So
I suspect that
there's the other side of making sure they understand.
You're right. I ought to revise it and add that in. That's a good point. Data quality is on the table too. Any other?
One more. Any takers?
Yeah. I'm in a situation in Alaska where a division of behavioral health has electronic health records, and they interpreted one part of HIPAA where it talks about if you have a data set that's below 20,000, you have to de-identify the zip code. You have to group zip codes together so you can not infer too much about an individual client. Well, they've kind of used that as a blended instrument now so that they won't offer any information, any demographics about any group of a provider providing services to 20,000 people. If it's below 20,000, they offer no demographic information.
Yeah. And how are you to improve?
It's the other extreme of this, which is a data set, a public data set, under HIPAA, being so restricted that you can't get to some of this research, like what you're trying to get to or what we're trying to get to.
Yeah.
And have you guys heard of anything like that at that level?
We run into the same thing. I had a nice quotation from somebody. Why is it that when somebody doesn't want to do something, they quote HIPAA, even when it's not in context? HIPAA does not cover the kind of research I'm doing. And yet, the safe harbor rules were quoted by NCQA as what the survey firms she'll follow. They give a safety valve to her. They said if the statistician at the survey firm will certify that we cannot re-identify the data, that the protections are such that it's safe, then NCQA will take the survey firm's word.
That's the department's word.